Oh, hi, I'm Jan Morrison. Welcome. Inkscape is the special pattern of something that individualizes it, that makes it distinctive. Whatever it is, a tree, a person, an emotion, experience, a poem, anything, can have an Inkscape. And Hopkins would see that theologically as a key to the divine harmony in the world, a harmony which is full of many different kinds of things, a multiplicity contained in a harmony, a kind of paradoxical idea. And last time I gave out some examples of Inkscapes, which are simply a kind of description to the group, and invited people to write some. Just write a description of something around Holden Village that you see in a word or a phrase or a sentence or whatever. I have one more sheet of these things, if anybody would like it. We can even kind of pass it around if you like. Does anybody do that and would like to share it with us? Write an Inkscape?
Yeah, I did.
You did? Come on. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear it. Because, of course, an Inkscape is going to tell us something about the person who wrote it, as well as the thing that you're writing about. There's no way to really avoid that. So what that means is that it will be individual to you. Something that we wouldn't see, but you would see.
Well, you might see it.
What did you see?
Aluminum spears click at the yarn, bending, fitted, knitted, but not knots.
Wow, sounds like a Hopkins poem. I'm going to read that again.
Aluminum spears click at the yarn, bending, fitted, not knitted, but not knots.
That's very nice. It kind of has a tongue twister quality about it. It's at least like my name.
Well, I'm just learning how.
Okay, then that's very appropriate. I mean, what you've done there is to set up some words that capture the pattern of an event. Mm-hmm. You know, the feeling of the different aspects of the event coming together in as few words as possible. That's good. Anybody else? Have one you'd like to read.
I wrote one thing in my mind. I'm trying to think what I did. Let me give this and see if I can get it together in my mind again.
Jill, do you want to read yours?
It's all right. Okay, I wrote, the vocal staccato of the ground squirrel parallels her fibrillation as she discovers a possible source of the
moon. Oh, want to read that again? Well, wait till this fellow sits down and then... He can hear it. We're reading our Inkscapes. Some people actually did it.
Well, I did too.
Oh, you did too?
Well, that's great. Great.
Let's hear it again.
The vocal staccato of the ground squirrel parallels her fibrillation as she discovers a possible source of food.
Is that what the squirrels are doing when they make that noise?
I don't know. That's what I think they're doing.
That's great. So we've got knitting and we've got squirrels squirreling. And what have you got?
I don't know if it qualifies, but the waves jostled each other as they raced along between the walls of their railroad creek chute. Like cattle rushed to the oblivion of the slaughterhouse, they rushed toward cold oblivion of Lake Chelan.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's all on that little piece of paper.
That's wonderful. That's
wonderful.
It's got similes in it, all kinds of stuff. Philosophy.
Have you ever seen cattle in their chutes being
going on? Yeah, just they're in the they only move.
Yeah.
And the water doesn't move. Anybody else write an Inkscape this year?
I wasn't here, but I had wrote this for a birthday card.
Mm-hmm. Want to tell us what it is?
I wrote, may the wind aim your direction. May the moon give you wisdom. And may the sun light your path always.
That's brilliant. Very nice birthday present from nature. These Inkscapes are descriptive. They capture something crucial that you noticed about the world. And I noticed, too, that all of them have in them something dynamic. You know, yours especially with the water rushing down, but also the knitting, also the squirrel. And of course, you can You won't be surprised to realize that Hopkins had to think up another word to sound more dynamic than inscape, which almost sounds like, you know, a still life, as though it sits there. So he came up with this other word that we also talked about last time, in stress. And there is both of all of these inscapes, in stress, something about the forces in creation. Hopkins would say that in stress is that force that holds the inscape together. All right. Yeah, we can accept that, I suppose. And, of course, he interpreted that theologically, too, in saying that in stress is the force of God's will pulsating throughout all things. I suppose if you were a secularist, you might call it the life force, but it's a God force to Hopkins. And he relates it to the poet in that the poet's job is to in stress the in stress that's in creation because people don't notice it. So just pick them up, pretend you didn't
right,
do it.
The floor is clean.
Now I'll tell you that I've already dropped that box on my floor once. But my floor was very clean.
Yeah. So is it.
And I inspected each one. So. This is appropriate because what we're talking about now are the patterns and the way things hold together, and we're going to shift very quickly into how things fall apart.
And that's inertia.
Yeah. So we're almost, this is a little symbol of desolation.
Yeah.
drop your candies. Listen to this one quote that I read the other night, and think about what it means to the poet. Hopkins says, all things are charged with love, are charged with God, and if we know how to touch them, they give off sparks and take fire, yield drops and flow, ring and tell of him. He thought of the imagination as the hand within the mind, reaching out to touch creation. There's a lot of tactile imagery in Hopkins' poetry. Hi. Which is not always typical of a lot of male poetry that's love poetry. And I think Hopkins' poetry is love poetry, at least this nature poetry is. A lot of men's love poetry, I'm going to talk about love poetry next week, so I've got this on the brain, is more visual. And women's love poetry tends to be more tactile. So there's almost a feminine quality about this, if you want to use that in the quotation marks.
Definitely.
The touch. Through the poem, he wants to touch your pulses. And not just show you pictures. And we'll see how he does that tonight in some very different moods of the spirit. So a poem in stresses ideas, images, feelings, through every device in the poem is a way of in stressing what it's about. And a poem like God's Grandeur, which some of you know because you either read it before or we read it the other night, takes something like Psalm 71, the whole earth shall be filled with his majesty. And takes that and in stresses it, makes it into a poetic experience. The earth, the idea that the earth is charged with the grandeur of God, it's a very eventful kind of experience that makes this idea take hold and originate in you. So poems do in stress all the time, as did your inscapes. And you needn't worry too much about the technicalities of those terms. There was one other poem that is about the process of in stress in the person perceiving nature and in nature coming back that I wanted to read to you before we went into these poems of desolation so you can get the contrast. And in order to read Hurrahing in Harvest, which I don't have any more copies of, I've used up all the ones I could get out of the office. So if anybody has a copy of that with you, you might want to share it with someone next to you. Let me just say that the idea of in stress is an eccentric word, but it's not an eccentric idea. It's a very ancient idea. It's taken back a few centuries. It's an idea about the relationship between human beings and nature. There is a 17th century treatise on the art of painting from China, which is called the Mustard Seed Garden Manual. And in this book, it advises the artist that if he's going to paint a picture of a lutist playing his instrument under the moon, he has to show in the picture that the lutist is listening to the moon and the moon is listening to the lutist. reciprocity of attention in nature, you know, of which much modern poetry, like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, shows us exactly the opposite, where that's been, that relationship has been broken off. Now, if we listen to this poem, I think you can hear the excitement of the speaker as he connects with what's out there in creation. Hurrah in harvest. If you don't have a copy of this, you'll get something out of it, I'm sure, but not as much as if you could look at it. Summer ends now. Now, barbarous in beauty, the stooks rise around. By the way, stooks are what? Tim? Like corn shucks in the field. Summer ends now. Now, barbarous in beauty, the stooks rise around. Up above, what wind walks? What lovely behavior of silk sack clouds? Has wilder, willful, wavier meal drift molded ever and melted across skies? I walk, I lift up heart, eyes, down all that glory in the heavens to glean our Savior. And eyes, heart, what looks, what lips yet gave you a rapturous love's greeting of realer, a rounder replies. And the azurous hung hills are his world-wielding shoulder, majestic, as a stallion, stalwart, very violet sweet. These things were here, and but the beholder wanted, which two, when they once meet, the heart rears wings bold and bolder and hurls for him, oh, half hurls earth for him off under his feet. You get that image? At the end, just sort of throwing up his cap or something and leaping up above the ground. There's often that sort of rising of a figure in Hopkins' poems at the end. A friend of mine who's written this book about Hopkins called Mind with Emotion, M-I-N-E-D, which is a phrase from Hopkins. From Rutgers, Mary Lou Motto, argues that, you know, in Hopkins, poetry of ascent, A-S-S-E-N-T, that is, of ascent to God's creation, there's often an ascent, a liftoff, near the end of the poem. And a feeling that not only is it an ecstatic ending, but one which seems to promise even more ecstatic experiences further on. There's always that the glimmering of further possibilities. Well, that's one mood of Hopkins' poetry. But I don't want to give you the impression that he was only a Pollyanna or something, which of course I don't think he was. The poem God's Grandeur, which we read the other night, is also a social statement about industrialism, about nature ravaged, the inscapes of nature unselved by pollution. Nature spent for the sake of trade, and it is about that, and the poem and a lot of his other poetry is also about that equally desolate faithscape of the 19th century, when there is, you know, sermons are selling better than they've ever sold before, and yet there's a lot of doubt, a lot of questioning of the Bible and of religious institutions. In 1880, Hopkins was a Jesuit priest, by the way, those of you who don't know that part. He was a convert to Catholicism. And when he finally became a priest, he began to be moved around from parish to parish and served in a number of slum parishes. And this is a man, keep in mind, who's extremely sensitive to beauty and a brilliant, well-educated Oxonian from Oxford. And he's sent to Liverpool, near the heart of the Dockyard slums. And to Hopkins, it was a crushing experience. He says, Liverpool is of all places the most museless. And he would have agreed with, I think it was Oscar Wilde, who said that industry is the root of all ugliness. Industry in the new 19th century sense of the industrial landscape, industry in the old sense meant something very different, very positive. But he was horrified even more by what he thought of as the moral ugliness of the new civilization. And he has a lot of care for laborers. He spent many hours in confessionals with working class people and in preaching to them. and administering to them in their homes. And he has a number of poems about working class people. And knew firsthand the discontent of the working people as well as the despair of the unemployed in England. And he has at one point written what's known as his red letter, in which he declares himself in a manner a communist. He's using that word somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But let me read you some of what he says here. I must tell you, he's writing to Robert Bridges, his friend who published his poems, because I must tell, in 1918, long after he had died, I must tell you that I am always thinking of the communist future, he says. And he goes on, I'm afraid some great revolution is not far off. Now, he is afraid of it. I mean, he's not looking forward to it, as some people did in his day. Horrible to say, in a manner, I am a communist. Their ideal, except for some things, is nobler than that professed by any secular statesman I know of. Besides, it is just. I do not mean the means of getting to it are, but it is a dreadful thing for the greatest and most necessary part of a very rich nation to live a hard life without dignity, knowledge, comforts, delight, or hopes in the midst of plenty, which plenty they make. They profess that they do not care what they wreck and burn. The old civilization and order must be destroyed. This is a dreadful lookout. But what has the old civilization done for them? As it at present stands in England, it is itself in great measure founded on wrecking. England has grown hugely wealthy, but this wealth has not reached the working classes. I expect it has made their condition worse. Besides this iniquitous order, the old civilization embodies another order, mostly old, the old religion, learning, law, etc., and all the history that is preserved in standing monuments. But as the working classes have not been educated, they know next to nothing of all this and cannot be expected to care if they destroy it. The more I look, the more black and deservedly black the future looks, so I will write no more. And in another of his letters, a little bit later, he simply says this, my Liverpool and Glasgow experience, and Glasgow is equally dismal, place in the 19th century, and he was there too. My Liverpool and Glasgow experience laid upon my mind a conviction, a truly crushing conviction, of the misery of the town life to the poor, and more than to the poor, of the degradation of our race, of the hollowness of this century's civilization. So when Hopkins says things that sound like Conrad's The Horror and Heart of Darkness. Now, you might know that book. It rings a bell. It's a kind of analysis that it was common in his time and that he reached as well. But he had personal reasons for his desolation, too. And these are especially things that we can relate to in our own ways. He was obscure both as a priest and a poet. He had no public he was writing for, really, no hope of publication. And felt very unappreciated. And I think most of us have probably experienced that sometime, and maybe more than enough of it. Secondly, he was separated from his family by religion. They were Anglican, he was Roman Catholic. They may seem close to you, but they were not in the 19th century. He had crossed over the divide to Rome. In England, the English hate Catholics on the whole. I mean, that's sort of a just general English thing, so that's both part of it. And then by vocation, he was a priest, and so he had eschewed, you know, the whole business of getting married and having family, making money, all of that. You know, he was apart from all of those dominant values of his time. He was also separated from them by distance. He didn't live near them, didn't see them. He kept moving around from parish to parish. And he was, as a Jesuit, in a very disciplined, highly disciplined, almost militaristic order. And that the pressure of that told on him, as did the hard work. Now, none of us here, I assume, are Jesuit priests, am I correct?
I wonder why.
But, you know, but there are similar things in our own lives.
I've been doing this for 11 years.
Were you really? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I hope I haven't profaned your past life. What were you going to
well,
say?
Well, I was going to say, it seems strange to me that he would become a Jesuit rather than, say, a Franciscan. Because I would think that that Franciscan order would have been more in tune with his. He may not have known.
They might not have been established in England. I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know about the Franciscans, but there's a long history of literature and science and specialization in that area in the Jesuits. Théard de Chardin was a French Jesuit, not really contemporary. But, also, you often don't have a choice. I entered the Jesuits at 17 and didn't know a lot of, I'm not sorry I did, but I didn't sit down and carefully calculate my 20 different choices.
So. Well, I think it's the learning and the reputation of the Jesuits for such excellence in those kinds of things that would have attracted a man like Hopkins as well. Of course, there are books written on this subject of how the Jesuit order influenced his poetry or de-influenced it, you know, what things it has in common, and what he learned from St. Ignatius Loyola's spiritual exercises and so on, and how that helped and didn't help. He had worked very hard at two, just at both in Liverpool, where he spent hours and hours in the confessional, in one of his letters. His exasperation comes through, and he says, "And the drunkards go on drinking. The filthy, as Scripture says, are filthy still. Human nature is so inveterate. Would that I had seen the last of it." And he's talking about human nature, not just about a class there. And when he moved to Dublin in 1884, where he was for 5 years at Cardinal Newman's University, held the chair of Greek, at a time when the university was falling into ruin, and he had to hold 6 classics examinations a year for 750 candidates and grade all their exams. He did not have a graduate TA to do it for him. And of course, these would have been in classical languages, and he ruined his eyes grading them. Well, when you do that kind of work, you really don't have a lot of energy left to write poetry. And Ireland was a heartbreaking place for him because there was a lot of agitation and unrest about home rule. It was the era of Parnell, if you know anything about Irish history. And so low spirits, and certainly for some very good reasons, as well as poor health, drove away his muse. And in one of his poems, he prays, "O thou Lord of life, send my roots rain." And I thought what we might do is read that together. One of these poems, this one especially, is about his experience in Ireland. And then look at some of the other desolation sonnets on here. There are, I just printed 2, and we have them on that begins to take him out of it.
Jan, I got the Oxford edition you mentioned from the library? Yeah, from the library here. There was one that really struck me.
These are really difficult poems, these desolation poems. My fingers are all thumbs.
Maybe I'll just send this around so people know what it looks like and it has some of the pictures. Should I do it now?
With those drawings we were talking about? Hopkins was a very good draftsman and drew things as a discipline of the eye. And that's what she's passing around in some of those pictures. That's great, thank you.
And it's in the library here.
I didn't even know that that book was there. To Seem the Stranger, let's look at that one. It's up on the top left-hand corner. This poem, very interestingly, starts out by making what seems like simple statement, and then it gets more and more complicated as it goes along, I think. Starts out sounding very simple, in a way illustrating or embodying the idea in the first couple of lines. But there's different kinds of alienation that this poem is about. To seem the stranger lies my lot, my life among strangers. Father and mother dear, brothers and sisters are in Christ not near, and he my peace, my parting, sword and strife. England, whose honor oh all my heart woos, wife to my creating thought, would neither hear me were I pleading, plead nor do I. I weary of idle a being but by where wars are rife. I am in Ireland now, now I am at a third remove. Not but in all removes I can kind love both give and get. Only what word wisest my heart breathes, dark heaven's baffling ban bars or hell's spell thwarts. This to hoard unheard, heard unheeded, leaves me a lonely began. What are the different kinds of alienation that you notice in this sad poem?
No country, no family.
They're still dear, you know, and yeah. He uses that word dear a lot in his poetry. They're still dear, but they're not near. Yeah. And it's one of the ways Hawkins uses a rhyme to bring out the contrast between those two things.
It seems strange to me that he's always using verbs as nouns. And one of the things that bugs me about many people today is that they use nouns as verbs.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that ironic?
Like journaling?
Journaling, how's that? How many of you have journaled?
Networking.
That's really what's happened, so that the life has come out of the verbs. And making a verb, making a noun into a verb takes a life out of the other, and the other verbs then get lost.
Yeah, I think it really muddies the language, and it seems to me that he's almost doing the same thing in reverse here.
Maybe doing it in reverse is a way to make you rethink the words, though.
Maybe.
You know, he may have that in mind. What words are you thinking of here?
Well, I'm thinking of leaves me a lonely began. Yeah.
Why do you say that? What do you think about that?
I can't figure it out. That's why it sort of leaves me. And also up in the third verse, and now I am at a third remove. I don't get either one of those.
All right.
I must be dense.
Anybody else? It's easy to just sit there and look at it and wonder what he means, and then all of a sudden it dawns on you.
I hope this may be far off. This is not addressing either of these two themselves, but kind of parallels his idea of seeing action or stress in objects, you know, like a tree or a flower or, you know, things that you wouldn't ever think of having action in themselves, and, you know, putting action into making a noun into a verb.
It's a way of showing the stress and the force within things.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's not what he's getting at, but that's what I see.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true of him. I mean, it sounds like a good theory. anybody have an idea about that last line? Leaves me a lonely began.
He's talking about a lonely beginning, but he's done it so much that he began again. It's a concept.
It's a concept. What is the concept of began? What does it mean to be a beginning?
Or a beginning that he's already begun. Leaves me a lonely, that was my sense, a lonely new beginning, but then I've already begun this new beginning, so it's a lonely began. And in that sense, it's real concise imagery that there's something that I'm looking forward to doing, but I realize in a very real sense I've already taken the first step in this new journey. And what a wonderful way to say it. As verbose as I just did.
You always have to do that. And, you know, Hopkins himself, in his letters explaining his meanings to Robert Bridges, said it's a terrible thing to explain this thing in cold blood, you know. and I always think that, you know, there should be a period of meditation after a poem is read of maybe 30 minutes before anybody says anything. But by that time, the class bell has rung, so you never really do that properly.
There's kind of ambiguity, too, because it could be... it leaves me with a lonely began, or it could be that that is something one is left with, or it could be it leaves me as a lonely began. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get a blurring between the subject and the condition of the subject.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. There's a couple of these other poems have an ambiguous ending like that, where you can't tell exactly what part of speech that chunk of language is, and whether or not there's a word left out that would change the meaning of it.
And also, I don't know if he also taught Hebrew, but there's a lot of making nouns from verbs in Hebrew, mm-hmm. and also omitting prepositions and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's the same kind of thing. It's almost like in a conversation, in an intimate conversation, one would know, mm-hmm. you know, there would be so much more going on, and uh-huh. so you don't need all the other words, but he's such a loner, it's hard to think of him in an intimate conversation.
I think you're getting at something very important about these poems that are, and that is that he seems sometimes to be talking to himself. And the way you do, you would, you know, kind of leave out words with your best friends, and the way that you would certainly with yourself in your own mind. And so you almost feel sometimes though you're overhearing him talking to himself. And here, he really isn't talking to God or to nature as he has been in other ones. Horion Harvest is a response outward, but here it's pretty much of an inward conversation. Now there are other people who say, well, but there's a lot of that talking to himself in the other poems too, so you have to figure out what you think about that.
But if we can contrast sort of the sense of desolation that is beginning to come up here versus the joy in the two meanings of ascent, you know, ascent like being propelled mm-hmm. upward and then ascent the longer term goal, mm-hmm. Here I think he sort of despairs of ever continuing on that journey, and he says one gets sort of kicked in the pants and gets started in this, and then everything sort of falls out, and there you are.
Yeah.
And that's the sense I get.
Kind of ends in medias res, with no promise of a continuation of that began. It's a little bit like saying, I feel like a has-been, who never was, who never accomplished, who just began. So if it ended with the word beginning, which is generally a positive word in the way that we use it, you know, it would sound much more positive, but to say, put it in past tense, is really a sad thought.
Why wasn't he published? Was there a restriction in his order? That doesn't seem...
Yeah, there was, and things had to be reviewed by his superiors. There was a Jesuit magazine in which some things could be published, but the main poem that he wrote, The Wreck of the Dutchland in 1875, he had hoped to get published in that magazine. It was, after all, a religious poem about some nuns who got killed in a shipwreck. And he says that the magazine dared not publish it because the people wouldn't know what to do with it. So if we have trouble understanding it, we're used to some of this kind of stuff. Can you imagine the Victorians who were used to Tennyson understanding this kind of language?
Yeah, in that book that's going around, there's Bridges' poem to Hopkins upon the publication of his work in 1918. And Bridges' poem is so yucky. I mean, it's trite.
It's not very good, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And it's smaltzy and just, well.
Great word.
you think this guy was getting published instead of Hopkins?
Yeah.
Well, the reason. Uh-huh. Maybe the reason he didn't get published is because the guys who had to do the reviewing didn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so didn't want to put their nihil imprimatur obstat on it.
No. You know, and if they didn't understand it, then it could not clearly serve the cause of Christ.
Right.
If it were obscure. I mean, it's that simple. Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, have some ideas? Are you convinced? Began is a worthwhile thing to read. Mm-hmm. Created in that last word. What about the third remove that you brought up? Anybody have a theory about that?
Well, the superficial meaning, you mentioned he was in Liverpool and in Glasgow and then in Dublin, but I presume he was other places too, so it probably wouldn't mean that. And he said in the first paragraph that he was removed from his family, and in the second that he was removed from his country, but I couldn't figure out what a third one would be from that.
Well, it might just be from their religious life. I mean, he was worried that his family was going to hell because they were not in the church. Mm-hmm. So that's really being quite divided from eternity. And so perhaps the religious alienation is the third remove. I'm not sure how
that's
count.
That's what he's talking about at the end of the first stanza, are in Christ not near, and be my peace, my parting sword and strife.
Yeah. It's not just a domestic separation. It's a religious one that has eternal consequences. Mm-hmm. And he can't, you know, he's not going to convert his family. Many people would only be concerned with the first, but Hopkins' kind of piety would really make him very concerned about that second thing. So he's at third remove. In 1884, he had become so depressed and ill that he could not get on with his writing in Ireland, and in one of his letters he breaks out all in capital letters, and I wrote this up here, it's so shocking to find it's in Hopkins, is, and what does anything at all matter? And that's about the lowest he gets in his letters, just saying it like that. Other times he's a little more playful about it, black humor, we might call it. He said in one of his letters, they should see my heart and vitals all shaggy with the whitest hair.
What did he die of?
He was very sad. He said he thought at times that he was mad. I can't, some kind of fever. I can't remember exactly which kind of it was. Typical kind of 19th century illness where if he'd had proper medical care, he wouldn't have died. So let's read a few more. In 1885, in this year of this comment, he produced several sonnets which he said were written in blood, and these are called his dark sonnets, his terrible sonnets, sonnets of desolation. The word I think is from St. Ignatius Loyola. Let's take a look at the one right under that, no worse, there is none. And see how this differs from the physical description of the earlier poetry. No worst, there is none. Pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will, schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. Comforter, where is your comforting? Mary, mother of us, where is your relief? My cries heave herds long, huddle in a main, a chief woe, world's sorrow. On an age-old anvil, wince and sing, then lull, then leave off. Fury had shrieked, no lingering, let me be fell, force I must be brief. Oh, the mind, has mountains, cliffs of full, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, may who ne'er hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort, serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep. How is this like or unlike the earlier poetry we looked at, the descriptive poetry? Is it descriptive? Can you see landscapes? Where are these landscapes?
You see them in the inside of your mind, and the way you describe it. It's not as visual as the others. It doesn't invite you to make pictures, it invites you to feel it right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a sense there are some pictures that the mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathom. Sense of towering, desolate cliff that he's hanging on the edge of.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, hold him cheap, may when you're hung there.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what that line means, by the way? Anybody want to ask about that? You picked up kind of how he writes, leaving out.
Well, he says,
hold them cheap, may who near hung there. I often feel that way about some church people, if I may say that in this group. Who are so optimistic and have had such easy lives. They hold cheap other people's despair because they've never hung there. I met people like that. Anyway.
And is this cliff over the abyss of madness, perhaps? Or despair.
It's absolutely, you know, bottomless. It's bottomless. What were you going to say? I cut you off just a minute ago. You had something else you wanted to say, I think.
I may have.
It relates to nature imagery. For example, if we just kind of go through this and look at the images, or they're not always visual images, so look at is probably not the right word, but some of them are actually oral images. Pangs schooled at four pangs, wilder ring, an image from labor. Only what's being given birth to is a world woe, a world sorrow. And then, of course, Mary being brought up right after that is kind of ironic in a way. In the third line, we don't have an image. Instead, we have a reference to the comforter. And as I said last time, there are a lot of doves and comforters in Hopkins, and we're going to see another one for the session's over. But here, it's questions. And the questions have no answers and no response, at least in this poem. This is a mood, this is a time in his life. He goes on in other poems. Comforter, Mary, mother of us, he brings that in, you know, just kind of rubs our nose in it, in a way. Where is your relief? You can see why the Jesuits would not publish this. I mean, they're not going to publish this kind of poetry. It's very disturbing. And yet, you know, some of these images in these desolation sonnets are quite biblical, and especially the other one at the top of the page, I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day, and some of the other ones have very Jobian imagery in it, in them. Of these really terrible images of God as a monster in the book of Job, if you've ever read it, read all the way through. So it's not as though he's coming up with this all on his own. And then my cries heave herds long. I don't know how to picture that, but it just, you know, makes your heart sink to read it. And then we have huddling a mane, the suggestive sort of sheep huddling, and that later on the reference to the shelter kind of brings that in a storm. On an age-old anvil wince and sings, another kind of pain. There's this one kind of pain after another, as though even though he says in the opening line, no worse, there is none, there's one worst after another, and then we then the bottomless pit. You think it's the worst, and there's more. Fury had shrieked, no lingering, but the word lingering lingers. It goes over a line. Mm-hmm. So fury lies too. And there are a lot of contradictions in this, in these desolation sonnets. They're very disturbing. Let me be fell means let me be cruel. But the idea of falling then produces the next series of images, which I'm sure Hopkins has in mind, falling in the sense of sin, but also in the other senses we talked about. So there are natural images here, but they're transformed into nightmare. Did anybody pick up the reference to Shakespeare in the last few lines? Yeah, Shakespeare play, anybody have any?
To sleep for chance to dream?
Well, actually that does say something different, doesn't it?
Or out of Macbeth, about out we candle, life of the temple, sound of fury, mm-hmm. I get mixed up here, told many days, things like that.
The fury is in here, isn't it? Yeah. I think a number of Shakespearean echoes, more than maybe I thought. I was thinking of King Lear. You know that big storm scene in King Lear? And
yeah.
You know, goes into the shelter.
I kind of feel like there's a storm, and you can see a black cliff and the waves crashing up there. And he's just ready to fall off. Jump up.
A poem like this is pretty hard to resolve, and there are no answers. Cries, and then quiet. And it resolves to a kind of quiet. Sort of poetry of endurance, but not moving toward conversion or toward summing up, or the poem takes no turn at the end to sort of have a, what my students always think they have to add on to their themes, or kind of the happy ending. None of that. And I think it's for that honesty of this kind of poetry that people appreciate, Hopkins especially. Let's look at the one at the top of the page.
I just wanted to ask more thing about this. Is this intricate rhyme scheme he has here a specific form? Is it a sonnet, or is this something that he has developed for this poem?
Sort of 14 A-B-B. Lines.
A, B, B, A, B, B, and then C, D, C, 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 D, D, or something like that.
I never worked that out, because I always think his internal rhymes are more interesting than the ones on the end, but in fact, it might be an Italian sonnet, I'm not sure.
Well, he goes out of his way to point that out, by the way, that the words do wrap over the line so that the rhyming syllable comes at the end.
Yeah. And the very way that, when a poet does that and has lines end in the middle of the next line, and here there are any number of breaks like that, it kind of destroys a sense of orderly, you know, advance of the poem. If you have end-stopped rhymes, like in Pope, it sounds very orderly, but this is more disorderly, because the lines end at different points. And this poem is about chaos. So it would be interesting to think about what kind of sonnet that is and how that relates to the chaos. And because there is a pattern here. Mm-hmm. In spite of all of the chaos, it's there. But it's very hard to find. And at this moment, the poet can't find it.
I was going to say, I'm not familiar with this desolation poetry, but it's interesting how the words themselves, which is one of the reasons that I've liked Hopkins before, the imagery, if you sit down and really examine it, then it kind of fleshes out a meaning, but just the sheer sound of the words, and here the sound of the words in a way is put them together, is as desolate as his other poems are, creative and full of life and kind of, you know, light and bubbly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how he does that, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he unstresses the experience all right. Mm-hmm.
They're all 14 lines, all four of them.
They're all sonnets. You know, I don't think anybody's ever written sonnets like this before Hopkins. I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh, what black hours we have spent this night. What sights you heart saw, ways you went, and more must in yet longer light's delay. With witness I speak this, but where I say hours, I mean years, mean life. And my lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him that lives, alas, away. I am gall, I am heartburn. God's most deep decree bitter would have me taste. My taste was me. Bones built in me, flesh filled, blood brimmed the curse. Self yeast of spirit, a dull dough sours. I see the lost are like this, and their scourge to be as I am mine, their sweating selves, but worth. Now there's your innovation on a word, the fell of dark.
Yeah, that's good.
Now here you've got a past tense, the fell of dark, that suggests that dark fell, and it feels to me at least as though it's never going to rise, lift again. It fell. It's one of the ways he uses those single syllable words to just make a flat.
Oh, I have another idea.
Fine. I'm sure there are several things.
Yeah, here. The fell is a hollow, mountainous valley.
Oh yeah, it's a word. It's a geographical.
Yeah,
word.
Yeah.
And fell is also an adjective in the fell clutch of circumstance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which means mm-hmm. one fell swoop.
Yes.
It's a very rich word related to the word fall, and so it has those associations too.
Yeah. All of those.
The fell of dark that day. How ironic, you know. You wake and it's dark that day. But also a dark that doesn't seem as though it's ever going to go away.
Yeah. And it really seems like this seems very Shakespearean to me.
Yeah, me too.
The vocabulary, black hours, mm-hmm. Longer light's delay, my lament, God's most deep decree, self yeast of spirit.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like a real restating of that same sentiment.
Again, he's talking to his heart, you know, rather than to anything outside of himself, addressing his heart, you heart, which suggests a kind of intimacy, but also a sort of separation. I mean, he's talking to himself, so he's engaging in what the Victorians called the dialogue of the mind with itself, a sign of the age's alienation. And many poems in the Victorian period have a kind of dialogue going on between different sides of a question or different sides about a character or a person. Any number of poems do that quite openly. Anything else you want to comment on here about the images or the ways that he inscapes this experience? There's a lot of differences between this and the other poems. Of course, the light that he's waiting for is grace, is a sense of God's grace, not just the daylight. Let's read one other poem. It takes him a little farther. And this is not a difficult poem at all, my own heart. My own heart, let me more have pity on. Let me live to my sad self hereafter, kind, charitable. Not live this tormented mind with this tormented mind tormenting yet. I cast for comfort I can no more get by groping round my comfortless than blind eyes in their dark can day or thirst can find, thirsts all in all in a world of wet. Soul, self, come poor Jack self, I do advise you, Jane, let be. Call off thoughts a while elsewhere. Leave comfort root room. Let joy sighs at God knows when to God knows what, whose smiles not wrong see you, unforeseen times rather, as skies between high mountains. Lights a lovely mile. A sort of pleasant surprise at the end of all of that pain in that poem. One of the things I like about this poem is that, to say maybe one or two more things about it, is the way that in it, in spite of its, you know, its comfort and its peace that he begins to find here, there are little aftershocks of the experience he's been through. And I've certainly experienced that too, that even when you get through a terrific struggle of some kind, you can still re-experience it from time to time, like the aftershocks of an earthquake. And so we have those lines, with this tormented mind tormenting yet, you know, that sense of going back and forth that we heard in the other poems. And he remembers it and the obscurity and difficulty and entrapment of it in the second stanza too, so that it will take a while to kind of figure out what he's saying there. He remembers what it was like to be thirsty and blind and comfortless. But then he shifts into a different, entirely different key. And what lights the lovely mile at the end is God's smile. At least that's the way some people figure out that syntax. And what I like about that last phrase, lights a lovely mile, is it's a kind of pleasant sigh, and it suggests the word smile without saying it. But it's enough for the moment. What I'd like to talk about tomorrow is the theology of failure and obscurity that Hawkins developed out of his own Christology. These are experiential poems expressive of desolation, but he also has some ideas about the value of suffering and the feeling of obscurity and failure. And we might want to talk about those some more next time with some other poems that are poems of resurrection and hope. So hope you come back. Thanks.
Thank you. Did you write your instinct?